So today I'll talk about that subject, semi-classical fields and the lattice. It's kind of a working up to it. I first wanted to make some remarks about the classical approximation review, what we've been doing with Wai-Hung Tang and Gert Aerts, who is here. Since semi-classical approximation, the way I see it, is supposed to be an improvement on the classical approximation, then I will discuss some aspects of a semi-classical approximation, which is not what's then been done yet. It hasn't been implemented yet, but in a slightly modified form, it has been started in a toy model with fermions, the one-dimensional Biron-Higgs model, and perhaps I will give some time, spend some time on lattice details, which I think are interesting, and this latter work has also been done together with Gert. So, first let's look at the classical approximation. It's really an effective approximation. And let's first consider the hot scalar fields. Now, we all have seen these arguments over and over again in this workshop, that for large temperatures, the occupation numbers are high for not too high momentum modes. And but there's a problem, of course, with the high momentum modes, because then this factor is not small here. I forgot to divide by the temperature there. Now, the way I went about it is just like, just do it. Let's do it. Let's replace the quantum average at finite temperature for correlation function classical and see what you get and see how it behaves. I mean, you want to study the approximation first, study its properties. So the idea is then that in this classical average, you have an effective Hamiltonian written here. It looks purely classical, but the couplings are supposed to be effective in a way I'll explain later. And the idea is then that this Hamiltonian generates initial conditions as a Boltzmann weight, and with these initial conditions you evolve the fields in real time with the Hamilton equations, and then you average over the initial conditions. Now, as you look at the time-independent case, then, as you can see here, well, you can argue that then what happens is that this pi squared doesn't matter here, so you just have the potential part of the action, and it just looks like dimensional reduction. You have a field theory in one dimension lower. So that is the dimensional reduction approximation, and that means that these effective couplings I talked about can then be just taken over by calculations people have done for dimensional reduction. That's like a minimal requirement. And that determines all of them except for this coefficient of pi squared here, which I've called z. It's not determined by this purely static approximation. And in a way, this determines the time scale. The time scale isn't set, but of course, in a static, the time independent approximation, that doesn't matter. Now, this dimensional reduced theory is a super renormalizable theory, so regularization artifacts can be made arbitrarily small. And matching to the quantum theory, I have heard yesterday some details about that, determines then the effective couplings, say, in the MS bar scheme, in terms of the couplings in the MS bar scheme of the original 3 plus 1 dimensional quantum theory. Now, I've listed here some when the classical theory is treated with a momentum cutoff. There are similar formulas on the lattice. So the effective mass parameter has, say, some other mass and a correction. correction can be calculated. In a supernormalizable theory, you don't have to go beyond second order in the coupling. This mass square then is a Emmett's bar kind of mass parameter plus the thermal mass. And there is cutoff dependence here explicitly in these counter terms. And there are finer terms here that are determined by the matching with the quantum theory. Funny numbers that would be different numbers if you were on the lattice. Now there is a kind of fake thing here that you could even think of renormalizing the Rayleigh-Jeans divergence. It's kind of fake because you subtract it away. It's here in these cutoff dependent terms. And you replace then the answer by the by the real thing you have in the real quantum theory. And that's just like renormalizing the cosmological constant. You can think of also doing that. In principle, you can match all parameters in the effective Hamiltonian. I didn't introduce a constant in the effective Hamiltonian, but you could do it, an effective epsilon that you would have to renormalize that way too. It seems like a cheap method to to do it. If it would have some consequences, for instance, the I will come back to this later briefly. If you could do, say, correlation functions of the energy momentum tensor and get them also finite and correct, then it would be much more.
Or if you have it for gravity, you definitely would have to renormalize your energy momentum tensor.
Yes. Gravity is a finite temperature classical field, so yes. Now, the time-dependent case is a new thing. And what Gert and I did is analyze it in perturbation theory. You start out with the free field, say, lambda equals zero solution in terms of the initial conditions written here in momentum space. And then you have a correction that you can calculate in perturbation theory with the retarded Green function and so on. There's also a Boltzmann factor that has an interaction term in it, and you expand that as well. You do everything analytically and you average over the initial pi and phi. And you find then up to two loops. This was first done by Boerdeker, McLaren, Smilga, say up to one loop. But up to two loops, you find for the scalar field theory that the divergences that appear, the new divergences at two loop, that they are all taken care of by the counter terms determined already via dimensional reduction, by the matching. You get this kind of diagram. You get so interesting momentum and frequency dependence. You can calculate the damping rate, purely classical, the way indicated here, and you find a certain answer for it, and you find first of all that it is finite. The z is taken to be one. Let me put this let's remind you what z is mentioned here. It's this z. We don't. What we find in a later paper, that I think it's one up till to the accuracy needed, up to the two loops. But at this stage, in our first paper, which was just described in words what I just said, we didn't calculate it. We just went about and assumed it to be one, because it's like a wave function renormalization, and these things occur in normal scalar field theory only at two-loop order. So it's reasonable to think it's 1 plus order lambda squared.
So you're just inserting now for your Hamiltonian this new phi of x, or what do you mean by, what do you really...
What do I do?
Yes, what do you really do? You use the CPT formulation and...
No. Just as I said it. You have these initial conditions in momentum space. You just calculate what the time evolution is for the scalar field with such initial conditions. Then you add the interactions, perturbative. It's completely, it's classical perturbation theory. It's very awkward. Right.
That you do it. Okay, fine.
It's very awkward to do it this way, but to two loops you can still do it.
Loop them.
A loop. What is a loop? Ah, I haven't put enough details in. So if you go to higher orders, you get combinations of two types of correlators. You have a you have a correlator that has to do with an equal time correlator, say, by averaging over the initial condition. It is like an equal time, but it's easily extendable to not equal time. Of those first order, zeroth order fields here, where is it? Here, those ones. This one. You average over the pi and the phi with the free Boltzmann factor, then you get that kind of correlator. And then there are, so that is the solid line here. And then there is a retarded propagation by this solid line, dotted line, because it's not symmetric. The solid, that one is symmetric. Am I saying it correct? This diagram we don't find. Okay. Now, in the second paper, we analyze this procedure a little bit more systematically. This way of going about it is very awkward, as I said. And in the second paper, we did it more like you do in thermal field theory. You have some in thermal field theory, you have a method where the average of initial condition is sort of replaced by the KMS condition. You just take the KMS condition, you have this closed time path where the initial time is sent to minus infinity, the final time to plus infinity, and then you have the KMS condition to recover temperature. There's also a classical KMS condition. And in this way you derive in the classical theory diagrams in a quite straightforward way. And you find again this diagram, and we compared it to the quantum theory because we wanted to have a closer look at the comparison with the time-dependent quantum field theory with the closed time path formalism and the classical time-dependent theory. And in the quantum theory you get in the classical approximation where you replace this Bose-Einstein factor by its leading temperature behavior, you get also another diagram. But it is subleading compared to this one. So the classical one dominates.
KMS condition periodicity is actually a constant
supply. Well, there's a similar one in the classical case. It's
the relation between time and temperature, there's an H bar. So what do you mean by classical KMS condition?
I can't write it down off by heart, but I can look it up in the paper.
I can say more.
Okay.
In general, the KMS condition tells you that the Boltzmann wave averaging is done with the same Hamiltonian as the time evolution. And that's why in the quantum KMS condition you can use the periodicity of the trace to get these Hamiltonian in the Boltzmann wave and Hamiltonian for the time evolution, that flips them around. Then if you just think about that the averaging and the dynamic is done with the same Hamiltonian, you can also do it classically. The problem is that you don't have a trace, but the idea is the same, that the Boltzmann averaging and the dynamic is governed by the same Hamiltonian.
If I call these things S naught, then the KMS condition says in the classical case, S naught in K space is minus I the temperature over K naught times the retarded Green function minus the advanced Green function. It can be re-expressed in that way. And in the quantum case you would have here the Bose-Einstein factor, I think plus a half in the quantum case. So in this it's quite analogous.
Okay, but you don't mean any periodicity?
No. It's this more reworked KMS condition. So, as was also mentioned yesterday, what we found, just going about it in this most straightforward way is that you can extract a plasmon damping rate and from those diagrams, those sun setting sun diagrams, and it has this form. But now this is in terms of the mass that appears, say, in your equations, that appears in this omega.
This is the higher dimensional mass, so the mu, you had a mu which you...
Right, I had a mu which I replaced by an m squared plus counter terms. And the counter terms have finite parts determined by the dimensional reduction, but basically it's the m squared is the renormalized mass in the classical theory.
In the classical theory or in the higher?
No, I'm now talking about the classical theory, but the matching determines its form in terms of the ms bar mass in the quantum theory, and that's the thermal mass also entering there.
I thought mu was the thing in your classical Hamiltonian.
Right, it is here. It says it's here.
Right.
So
mu is the thing. And if you do a perturbative expansion, there's a delta m squared.
Mu is the bare mass in the classical theory.
Yeah. Which you treat as cutoff independent?
No. It has explicit cutoff. Because this is.
M is cutoff independent.
M is cutoff. This is the ms bar, you know, the ms bar scheme. And here you see explicitly the cutoff dependence coming at a log 1 at 2 loop and a linear 1 at 1 loop.
And the leading order.
Yeah, it is like renormalization in the quantum.
But you're involved with mu, right? Not m.
There is no difference for
your. In renormalized perturbation theory, you start with the renormalized mass as your starting point. You do the same thing here. You start with the renormalized mass. Right.
When you evolve the classical equation.
You have the renormalized mass in these omegas.
Yeah, not mu.
No, but mu, there is mu present in the dynamics, let's say. So, but then next to the setting sun diagram, you also have like counter term insertions, which come if you split the mu in a finite part and a counter term part.
Yeah.
So these counter term insertions are also treated there, so that effectively you have only the renormalized mass in the final result, let's say. So you do the dynamics with the bare parameters.
But then you re-express the bare in terms of the renormalized ones and expand again, like in field theory, in quantum field theory. So if you would just renormalize in the classical field theory by inspection and you didn't know about the matching field dimensional reduction, then this would be the answer, which looks different from the quantum theory. But now we also have these matching formulas. And then we know that this M for high temperatures goes, you know, has the thermal component in it. That's this formula. M is like the ms bar mass plus m thermal. So for high temperatures, m thermal will dominate. So in the leading high temperature limit, we put m thermal in, and really m thermal has the hidden h bar in it. It's a quantum m thermal from the matching. It's proportional to 1 over root h bar. So then you just insert it, and you find, we're happy to find that we got the quantum rate, the well-known quantum plasmon damping rate, which goes like lambda 3 halves times the temperature with some funny factors there, which then has the hidden h-bar in it as well. But that only comes in from the matching. Of course, the classical theory doesn't know about the h-bar.
Sorry, I'm still confused. This comes from solving a linear equation in quantum with the self-energy?
No, it's non-linear. It's just a classical field equation. You expand that classical, you know.
This is the rate at which the classical field decays at late times, given any initial condition away from zero? Or, I mean, what rate is this?
It is a rate, as far as I understand it. If you have an, exactly as you said, you have an initial condition, you have a sort of intermediate exponential regime where you have this damping rate visible, and then of course, at large times you may have powers, you know, the power tail, the long time tails. We're not talking about that. We're talking about sort of an intermediate regime where the this damping dominates.
What correlator do you actually compute?
The phi phi correlator. So phi of t, say phi of zero, in the full expanded in.
And the bracket is averaging over the
initial thermal condition.
Yeah.
That's of course one important implicit assumption, that is all the higher spring functions can be taken solid. I mean, you know, if I just want to relate to Engel's approach. I mean, the assumption is that you look at the perturbation of the only phi differs from the thermal equilibrium value, and the higher correlation functions are actually essentially the thermal correlation functions.
I don't understand what you're saying.
He doesn't need to assume that. It's
I think that answers somewhere in the whole linear response theory.
Well, it's not linear response theory.
That was my first question.
I'm just looking at the propagator.
It's not linear. It's just you're solving like a classical n-harmonic oscillator, and you're doing that by perturbation theory.
And then you calculate such a correlator, and then you write it as something like 1 over n with a denominator which has an imaginary part. The usual thing.
That's two things.
But this is
this correlator, of course, you can perfect. This correlator, you can, of course, just perfectly calculate it in thermal equilibrium. It's just an equilibrium property.
Yeah,
you
can
associate.
This
two-point function, you just can calculate it perturbatively.
Right.
The association of this quantity with the damping rate, it is at this moment where you. Have this additional assumption. Which is linear response.
Sure.
Otherwise, it's just the correlation function. And
sure.
If you want to make a step from the correlation function to a damping rate, you have to assume that this appears, this type of correlation function exactly appears if you assume that you have a small perturbation, but only a perturbation in phi and not in the higher correlation function. And you want to know what is the time evolution of this small perturbation. Then in the expression in linear response theory, this particular correlator will appear. And that's how you can associate it to a damping rate. If you would have some other excitations, where not only phi is excited, but simultaneously also some other correlation functions, would of course not be the appropriate damping rate.
But it's also a damping rate in this respect. That correlator will look like this. And if you match this to an exponential decay, then that's
just,
right.
That's just a property of non-equal time correlation.
Okay, but we're not saying anything else.
Let me tell you otherwise. If you could universally associate that with the real damping rate of your system under arbitrary conditions, you would have solved the old Boltzmann problem of equilibration, because you would not be able to show that the system is equilibrated.
We're not going that far.
No, but it would have this implication that a small perturbation from equilibrium would always equilibrate. But of course, the loophole is that it's only a very particular excitation, and you are following a very particular assumption. In linear response theory, which is in general not fulfilled, because once you excite phi from its equilibrium value, after a very short time you will also excite the higher correlation function away from the equilibrium value, because they are coupled.
No, but he treats that in perturbation theory.
No, he thinks in
perturbation. Feedback only.
But those are much too high constructs on the simple thing we are doing. I'm calculating this correlation function. Look at it.
That's fine. That's just an equilibrium property.
Right.
But it's equilibrium.
The question I was trying to understand why that quantity calculated that way should be the quantum damping rate of what quantity? And then that's.
Of the same thing in the quantum theory. There's also a plasmon damping rate, the on shell plasmon damping rate.
It does involve linear response.
Sure. Okay,
otherwise
but
you cannot compare them.
No, but you also get it just from the propagate in the one or two loop approximation. I mean, that's all we are.
In quantum theory, you would say it's just the imaginary part of the two loop propagate, of the two loop cell manager.
We don't have to go into deep issues here. It's just comparing correlation functions. That's all we're doing. And the deep issues can, you know, they apply to both.
So the quantum range, the m h bar, the formal h bar goes to 0 limit is 0.
I don't know, it depends, I suppose so. I don't, there's a couple of lambdas here, and if you see lambdas, you know lambda is proportional to h bar.
That's assuming that the dominant contribution dominates. Of course, when you do the real limit, limit of h bar going to zero, it will not dominate.
You get this one.
It's just x constant.
Yeah.
That's the limit of h bar going to zero.
The
we have two terms in the mass.
The classical.
The classical part and then the thermal part. So if you switch off h bar, you switch off the thermal part. And only the first part will survive. So it's not diverging.
No, but this coupling usually has an H bar in it.
I mean, that first form.
But we take it classically as without H bar. That's how you go about
the first
it. But
formula is just an analytic calculation of the two loop diagram, right?
Right.
Okay, but then you have you put in M thermal.
The matching, yeah.
Right.
The matching via, yeah.
I mean, that's not what you observe when you draw that picture to do the classical simulation. That's not the rate you observe, right? Unless.
We would, if we put, we do the classical simulation with this thermal mass, we would observe it. I mean, M is a free parameter in the classical theory, so how do you compare at all with the quantum theory? You have to do some matching. And well, that's done via dimensional reduction, because it's easy.
I mean, there's an unusual crossover. I mean, we have two scales, one is temperature and the other one is the renormalized mass at zero temperature. And of course it just depends on which one is bigger. And that will limit.
I mean,
in the quantum theory.
The zero temperature mass is dominant, then the first formula will apply. And when the thermal contribution is dominant, the second formula applies, and then there is some crossover between those two. Because you have two.
Yeah, but the first formula is calculated in the classical theory, which is supposed to hold only in the high temperature limit. So, okay, all right, yeah, okay. No, you're right, you could do this even at low temperatures, yeah. So, I would be happy. And now say, now we know the parameters, now we can use the computer for non-perturbative effects. That hasn't been done yet. Now there was some discussion, could this also, say, reproduce on the computer via correlation function of the energy momentum tensor, the viscosity and so, the transport coefficient. I think the general view is not, because it's dominated by hard particles or so. But if it would, suppose it would do, then we learned last week that the shear viscosity goes like t cubed over lambda squared in the quantum theory. Now, in the classical theory, you have only, you have basically lambda always comes together with t. You have lambda t, and you have m thermal, say squared is lambda t squared. Lambda t squared. So from these two combinations, if you then would have to reproduce classically the same behavior as the quantum theory, you get, you come to this crazy formula. It doesn't look very likely to be true.
Or the cutoff could be
involved. Right. That's probably more likely.
That would really happen.
Yeah. Probably, if the shear viscosity is dominated by the hard thermal loops of the classical theory, then you would have one of these T's replaced by 1 over A, and you would get a different matching formula. Anyhow, so...
But I think we didn't measure it. And it was totally dominated by ultraviolet
Did you?
Yeah.
In 5 to the 4?
No,
no, Gates U. Gates U is a different matter.
Where?
But it of gives, of course, an indication that it's dominated by ultraviolet. Well, we find now here that the conclusion here is that for correlation functions, say of scalar fields, the scalar field theory is renormalizable. It's not dominated by ultraviolet. But it's the, maybe for composite operators like the energy momentum tensor, it's different. But for in the classical gate theory, even the correlation functions are not right, which I'm now reviewing and mentioning. For instance, if you look at the in scalar electrodynamics, you look at the in the gauge field case at the ordinal form factor or so, the self energy describing the self energy, then in the quantum theory it has this form. This is the biomass appearing there, written as an integral over the Bose distribution. But classically, this Bose distribution would be T over K, and you would get something proportional to a cutoff that you then have to put in. So it's divergent. And there are divergences which are non-local. They have this complicated momentum dependence in the classical theory. And you find this over and over again. You do. If you would do, and I've done it, say, diagrams like this we had before, say on the lattice with a lattice cutoff, you do classical perturbation theory, then find these non-local divergences. You basically get the physics of hard thermal loops multiplied by the cutoff.
I have a question. Before we switch to gauge theory, goes back to the parts of force here in the damping plate. I mean, there are two things you can measure numerically. You can start with the Boltzmann distribution and just measure this correlation function, and then compare it to the damping rate that you have computed. And the second thing you can try is start with an initial condition, which is not Boltzmann, but where the expectation value is different from Boltzmann. The order parameter is different from Boltzmann. You just start with a non-zero value of phi and keep all other prior correlation functions the same. And you let it evolve.
Wait, I don't understand what you mean higher order. It's not a scheme in terms of correlation functions.
No. If you want to specify initial condition, you can either specify, you have to specify a distribution. Now you're just assuming that you start with a thermal distribution.
Yes.
Which, of course, just specifies all correlation functions according to the thermal distribution.
But it's still a perturbation theory. Sorry.
Suppose we now use it non-perturbatively.
He will do so let's just get the concepts clear. So
okay.
It's essentially what you
okay.
You start with initial distribution, which has initial, if you want, time zero, some space correlation function according to thermal equilibrium. And then you let it evolve and you take. You measure the two-point function that would correspond directly to what you compute. Now, what I would be interesting to know is if you do a similar simulation where you are not starting with complete thermal equilibrium, but you just excite the order parameter phi to some non-zero small value. And then you just wait with your numerical simulation what happens. And then it would be very interesting to compare if the damping rate with this simulation corresponds to the damping rate that you extract from the two-point function. Because that would answer the old question if we can rely on linear response theory really to associate this two-point function to a physical damping. Did you do anything in this direction?
No.
But the other question is whether this particular correlation function you're calculating gives you the physical effect. Because you know from standard linear response theory that exciting the system either from thermal equilibrium, either by an external force, standard linear response, or by exciting one of the modes you're interested in, you exactly the same that you simply look at the correlation function that you're and mostly that is a composite correlation function, of course. But then you know from standard linear response theory that it doesn't matter how you perturb the system from thermal equilibrium because in first instance everything is linear, that's the assumption that that works, and then you find exactly the same results.
Yeah, but the problem is we do not really know if linear response is given by the right answer.
It gives the right answer. That has been proven over and over again, that linear response theory is, that it is fine. So as long as linear response theory is only valid close to equilibrium, of course. That's true, but close to equilibrium with a very wide margin.
But then we would have a proof that in an isolated system they will have data whenever you
it's
start sufficiently near, and I don't think that we have such a proof.
Yes,
that, I mean, if you just
exactly equivalent to a linearized Boltzmann equation. There is no difference between linear response and a linearized Boltzmann equation.
Yeah, but
all the problems that
no, linearized Boltzmann equations for some more time ago,
it's just as good as the nonlinear Boltzmann equation.
Yeah, the Boltzmann equations are not time ago.
Yeah, so and the linear.
But that's just the problem. We know that the microscopic equations are time reversible in this case. And we have to make this difficult step from time reversible microscopic equations to time non reversible equations like linear response and so on. And the whole problem of approach to thermal equilibrium, which is unsolved, is exactly how to make this.
I agree, but I do not
really know if linear response theory will be valid, because it really makes always this particular assumption that you only excite one mode and you just follow it. If you want, you have an infinite number of modes corresponding to all the correlation functions, and your real stability problem for small excitations is a matrix problem with infinitely many entries. And you would have to diagonalize this entry, this matrix, in a very complicated problem. So what linear response theory does, it just takes one diagonal element, let's say the diagonal element for the order parameter, and tries to compute that. But we do not really know...
Yeah, the energy flows out of that.
And the
of that mode, and you don't follow where it
and
goes.
And you do not follow where it goes.
That's why it's damped.
I'm opposed to that, but I'm opposed to your statement that you, by doing what you said at the beginning of this discussion, exciting another mode and see how it happens, that it would give the difference.
No, because he has microscopic time reversible equations, so he could test it. I mean, if you just start with a given initial condition, see a time reversible equation, you follow it in a numerical simulation.
Christoph wants to know if the classical system thermalizes.
Yes.
I don't doubt it.
But you should. That's not so obvious. I mean, these questions are often overlooked. There is no basic answer to that.
Well, if I look at high frequency or short distance modes, I can wait forever till it thermalizes. But if I look at a low momentum mode, I'm sure it thermalizes.
That's not so obvious. I want to see if somebody comes up with a clear proof that it thermalizes. I think this would be a really important finding. I mean, if you discuss with statistical physicists, nobody would claim that there's just no proof that isolated systems thermalize.
But there is ample numerical evidence that nonlinear systems thermalize if you do any time evolution.
But
I mean, Alex, you have done many calculations.
I don't know of any result of one plus one dimensional systems, but that's not really settled completely.
Well, of course, you can take it phase by case.
If somebody knows, that would be really interesting. If you have some numerical consistent proof that you just start somewhere, and then you show that asymptotically for late time you get the thermal correlation function, that would be a really interesting finding. Not so obvious. Actually, some people tell me that typically in Poisson the fourth theory, they just do not see thermalization. So I think it's an important open question that we should discuss at some moment.
in this workshop. I do not want our young folk to be too much, but
okay.
Come on,
no, maybe something for the afternoon. I don't know. I don't know of any systematic studies, even with hybrid Monte Carlo. After some time, you replace it by a new initial condition. But we have done very long calculations, so you have looked for a long time. You have a sort of microcanonical average, helped by a little bit averaging over initial conditions as well. But then in the microcanonical evolution, so the Hamilton evolution, we always saw empirically equilibration. That is certainly true. But it depends very much so, I think, on which observable you're following. Things start, you know, equilibrating for a certain... You see a certain observable settling
somewhere
in time. But I'm sure the high momentum modes will take forever. Yeah. Okay. I would like to mention, say, the SU2-Higgs model, which has been studied a lot by Alex and also by us, and of course Jan. But I would like to mention here now the relation to dimensional reduction and the matching, which we used. So here you have, say, two of these coefficients, which, in principle, are undetermined as the usual Plaquette action. So this is the effective Hamiltonian divided by the temperature. Then there are a couple of parameters, like the notation is weird here because these are not MS bar parameters, these are the effective lattice parameters, but we use this notation in the paper, so I didn't want to change it. So these are now, again, meant to be effective parameters, and dimensional reduction settles then the matching. These calculations have been done by Leiner a lot, the Chianti group, where they use, say, dimensional reduction to settle to study electroweak phase transition. So this beta, this lattice parameter, is then related to the gauge coupling at the lattice distance and the temperature. This lambda bar here is basically the ratio of the Higgs to W mass, and then there's this V squared. This looks like an expectation value. It has this complicated formula with a linear divergence and a log divergence in the lattice units, and there are weird parameters that depend on the lattice details that are the finite renormalization determined by the matching. And all these quantum field theory objects here are dimensional renormalization masses, so MS bar scheme masses and couplings. So this is the MS bar coupling at a certain, roughly at the temperature, and these are also running masses, really. Rho is the ratio of the Higgs and the W mass. You also find from the matching that ZE, the coefficient in front of the electric field and the coefficient in front of the canonical momentum of the scalar field, of the Higgs field, are roughly equal, but then they are undetermined and we just set them equal to 1. They determine the kinetic time scale of evolution.
What is this? They're determined by what principle? How do you...
This?
Yeah.
In principle, I think you would have to do, again, a perturbative calculation up to probably at least in time-dependent perturbation theory, like we did for the scalar field theory, and then you probably find already in one loop deviation of order g squared or so in this theory, which has trilinear couplings.
But dimensional reduction obviously doesn't
count. No, because in the static, I mean, it's in front of the non-static quantities like the canonical momentum, so dimensional reduction doesn't determine it, but it does determine the ratio, funny enough. Via the Gauss law and this kind of...
Your method with the CTP and all of that should in principle determine this factor, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So have you done these calculations in case theory?
No. Well, we have set E. We have calculated this set. the coefficient for electric field sets, just g squared,
1 plus d squared.
Yes, sorry, it's of course 1 plus ultraviolet temperatures, which you cancel from the 4d view, plus log of u of c.
It's just pi, don't
you? No, pi was. You need it as pi.
Okay.
But log divergence on
Berlin. But you have also, so I don't know how this puts in here, the covariant derivative of the A temporal gauge field. So,
yeah, that is absent here. Because we just took the classical gauge field theory and not his. They have an improved version. Which, so if you go through this, the following scheme, you have the average over initial conditions and you have the Gauss law here. And then you can write the Gauss law in terms of, say, this delta function with a parameter, in terms of a Fourier integral, where the dummy variable you call A naught. Then you integrate out the momenta, and then you get an effective action where A naught now appears. And in that form, the A naught squared term is like it appears like a joint Higgs field. The joint Higgs field has a very peculiar, well-determined form. For instance, its mass, m squared trace A naught squared or so, is there's no such term. There's no counter term for it. Which is related to the fact that the biomass is not finite in the classical theory. But in their improved calculation, they find not just this, they find such a term, you could say. And you can then do more. And in principle, everything is determined there. As far as I understand what you're saying, all these coefficients would be determined. You wouldn't find this simple classical theory, you find improvement. This is just classical and it's wrong. I mean, it has these divergences into the biomass, for instance. So there's no bare biomass put in. That means that the renormalized, the biomass coming out, will have, you miss this parameter to absorb mass divergences into the biomass, so it will come out divergent in the classical theory, in this version.
Now, this is what Dietrich calls a bad transformation.
Exactly, yeah. So there is something good in this matching, and there's essential stuff missing. This is old, this is a couple of years old. Anyhow, we measured some gauge invariant observables and their time-time correlation function. And I would like to show some results. It was in a way a tryout calculation. Can you do this? We didn't know. We weren't sure that we wouldn't be swamped by errors, statistical errors, and so forth. But it is not too bad. But it depends very much on which phase you are. You have a high temperature phase, say the plasma phase, and you have the low temperature Higgs phase. And here you see, for instance, the Higgs correlator. We call it Higgs. It's so the observable is just phi dagger phi. You call some Higgs field H, you say that it's just phi dagger phi. It's gauge invariant, and you call in the Higgs phase, you might expand it in perturbation theory, and then you pick up the Higgs field as the first term when this has an expectation value. And then it would be reasonable to call this the Higgs sort of gauge invariant version of the Higgs field. Anyhow, this is its autocorrelation function for two values of this, say, of the lattice cutoff. And they differ quite a bit. You see a damped oscillation. So you can extract the plasma frequency and damping rate. A similar thing you can do for the W. It does look a bit less nice already. The W, what we call the W, is like a gauge invariant version of the W field, which I think is reasonable to call it that way in the Higgs phase, but not in the in the plasma phase. It's like W, say, K vector is something like evaluated at lattice site X. Then you have the parallel transporter in the K direction, and then you have the Higgs field there. So you have a gauge invariant combination here. It's like a vector. So you have a Higgs on two lattice sites. You have a Higgs field here, Higgs field there, and then the parallel transporter. And correlation function in perturbation theory, this would give you, say, the normal W correlation functions. And non-perturbatively, you have to stick to this. And then in the high temperature phase, as Arnold, Son, and Jaffe pointed out, or Arnold and Jaffe, I don't know if you were in it too, they analyzed our results, and they said, well, it's very misleading to call this a W field. It's much more like a current, like the Higgs current as a source of the W field, and it behaves much more. And also Boedeker and Leiner had the same remarks, really. And he also studied these results that I'm now showing. Anyhow, you see here it's much less symmetric, and the damping is bigger. You cannot really see it, but the fluctuations and so there. Well, I didn't put on errors. The errors are big. So the results for the plasmon damping rate coming from those oscillations are shown here. And for instance, if you look at the black dots are the Higgs. did I call it damping rate? I mean plasmon frequencies, these are. So for the Higgs, the black dots apply. And you see, as a function of the physical temperatures, those is T over TC. TC, the critical, where the phase transition is here. And this is the plasmon frequency in physical units. So it's the omega in physical units, G squared T. So if things would then have to be cut off independent, then you can vary the cutoff and you would find the same result. And more or less that's the case for the Higgs, where we have the matching. It's a scalar field. The aiming of the bare parameters was not ideal here, but say this point and this point, the lattice distance differ by roughly 0.6, the lattice distance. So since they fall on the same curve as function of temperature, you would see, well, that works quite well. For the W, the corresponding points are this one and that point one. And as you can see, the error bars are quite small. And in our first version of the paper, I thought this is a fluke. And it's not too bad. It's not 0.6 difference, so it's quite good. But in effect, what you see here, the fact that this data point is higher, comes from the ultraviolet divergence. Really, it's sort of it's hardly visible, but it sets on, and you do see it. In the high temperature phase, the matching of the physical temperature was done better, and there you see, for instance, for the Higgs also, that the lattice spacings differing by 0.6 give basically within errors the same physical plasma frequency.
Yeah, since you know the cutoff and enters in this classical theory in a certain way,
yeah,
can one not correct for this?
Yes.
And read off?
Right. It fits the expectation. This little difference fits the expectation you get from a very simple formula. It has been studied more in detail, by perturbation theory, by Boedeker and Leiner. And it, you can understand the divergence, the size of it, and it fits.
Well,
but
and moreover, you can read off a continuum diagram.
No, because it's not renormalized. This gauge theory is not renormalizable classically, unfortunately.
But you can just subtract off the divergence, the cutoff.
Well, that's what would be like doing perturbation theory. So the aim was to do things non-perturbatively, but this was of course done as for studying the whole approach and see what, you know, what results do you get, and then you find that you do find agreement with perturbation theory, and perturbation theory tells you it's divergent, so you do find that agreement, and then you say, well, it's not good enough, because if I can't do more than perturbation theory, I might just as well do perturbation theory. But this is done completely numerical on the computer with initial conditions and all that. So in that sense, it's still some information. Non-perturbative, we get the same result.
By matching the parameters of your Platin Hamiltonian, you cannot do better, probably.
Right.
But of course, if you would include other parameters, higher order couplings like pi squared, independence on your ultraviolet cutoff.
It's not so much the scalar field that's the problem; it's the gauge field.
Yeah.
And to give
an example, this type of.
But the divergences in the gauge theory are non-local. You cannot match them, you cannot just put counter terms in that are local. You would have to have some, well, basically what Iancu this hard thermal loop business, or what Guy Moore has been talking about. Those are all efforts to do better, but it's not so simple there. Now, for the Sphaeron rate, My estimate of the situation is that it looks like this, your results, but this is Parmore and Turok, and Jan and Alex say their results don't show it, but they're still numerically they're compatible with inerrors with these, but okay, I'm sort of thinking along these lines, so it's proportional, the Sphaeron rate is proportional to the lattice distance. It's what I think one might say one finds. So it depends strongly on the lattice spacing. Then Arnold wrote a paper with sort of remedy formula. He says, you should find this, and now I have a sort of remedy formula. I've rewritten it in sort of a convenient way here, that the physical one, within large systematic errors of perhaps 30%, he says, would be done the lattice one times this fudge factor, but he calculates it, and then you get the coefficient. You get something like kappa is 75. Did I do this correctly?
Yeah, 3 times 25
is 75,
and the pi drops out.
Right. This pi times, yeah.
Kappa is the prefactor in front of alpha to the fourth, c to the fourth?
Kappa is the prefactor of alpha to the fifth.
Alpha to the fifth. Yes.
Yes, t to the fourth, yeah. So with Arnold's remedy and the bad behavior, classically we get still some results, which is like put this equal to 1, suffering something like...
prefect of alpha to the 4,
okay.
Because there is an alpha in kappa also, which makes the alpha to the 5th.
Okay.
Oh.
Is this...
Okay. This means that we have agreement with... The very old, very famous results that we did.
Right. The funny thing is...
That kappa is a 101, plus minus 50%.
All the improvements that have been made with hard thermal loop particles, with Hummel, Moore, and Boerdeker's equation, they all give finally the same numerical rate, the numerical value for the rate, funny enough.
This relation formula is based on what de Bruijn found, this highly anisotropic damping tensor,
right?
Which is numerically Norwich found.
Right. Well, yeah, true. But then there are questions about the numerical, about the correlation from you guys measured.
Well, but you're using what you.
Yes. No. That's you're quite right. I mean, you're doing what they sort of tell you to do, and then they say, well, you should stick to Gage in Verity, something like that.
So you're just quoting more into rock, or you?
No, but
it's... I'm quoting more into rock, which is in agreement with their data, but they... It's,
yeah.
It's
you had to, you didn't measure it in your simulation.
We did with the not in this is a pure gauge theory. Sorry, I should have. Yeah, this is without Higgs field, which is not what we did. But then in the high temperature phase, you find roughly the same answer anyway, independent of the Higgs field being present or not. But okay. Now so. I want to still make a case for the classical theory as a classical approximation. As a, well, it gives first answers to very difficult non-perturbative problems, and if you would then put AT equals 1, then you get an order of better than an order of magnitude. You get maybe within 50% the answer. You're laughing, but before, I mean, before we didn't, you don't know anything. Yes.
So
yes.
I'm
not saying we should stick to the classical approximation, but I'm just wanting to say that we shouldn't throw it away altogether, too. That's the conclusion. We should improve it. Now, one is Boedeker's equation, and the next thing what I'm now going to talk about is another proposal, which I want to argue, and then what Gert will talk about is sort of is closely related to that in the afternoon. What time is it?
10:35. So you're
okay.
You're
yeah, that's all right. I mean, I have this program which has on the last point on the lattice, and I know that. Perhaps only lattice physicists like the lattice, so I'm happy to skip this last point and be ready in time. You know, it doesn't really matter. So do you think it's good to have a break now? We started. Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
Okay.
Yeah. Is this a switch?
Yeah.
So, semi-classical, basically what I want to argue now, that the method that has been studied a lot by various groups, by Emil et al. And Hector, and well, we know all the people here, might be a good way to continue and improve. So the idea is then you take classical plus Gaussian, in quote, quantum fluctuations. It has to be somehow self-consistent in the sense that the fluctuations act back on the classical field, like a Hartree or a Lagrange approximation. Because if it were just a perturbation, then, you know, a perturbation on classical is perturbation, so you cannot really expect improvement. It has to be something that does a lot more. So therefore the word self-consistent. Now let's first look at quantum mechanics and your anharmonic oscillator. So the Hartree approximation would be something like this. You write the operator fields as a classical part, and then quantum part in terms of mode functions, F. And then you assume, you take into account Gaussian correlation, say, in initial state. The initial state is Gaussian. So you know all these expectation values, in particular this one, all the odd ones are zero. And even ones are what you expect from a Gaussian state. And since it's going to be true for all time, since the A's are time independent, this is like a Gaussian approximation for all time. Now you take that approximation, you get an effective Hamiltonian, as we have seen in Emil's very first talk. I've written it in terms of complex variables. So the N here is the average of A dagger A in the initial state, little n. And here you get this effective Hamiltonian that leads then to these equations of motion with certain initial conditions determined by the initial state. Mode functions, you have to decide sort of what mode functions you take, because that determines, together with the normalized creation and annihilation operators that are introduced, determines the initial state completely. Now for large n, the various factors of 3 here would be replaced by 1, but otherwise the equations look the same. And you basically have a set of simple equations. And what I learned from this is that the classical approximation will be good when the quantum correction, this psi squared, is small. So the classical part is completely contained in the Q itself, without the hat indicating the operator. Now, so far this has been a lot studied with Gaussian, you know, with a Gaussian density matrix, and that's what I've said so far. But that's too restrictive. For instance, at high temperature, you expect the classical approximation to be good, but then you expect the classical Boltzmann distribution to be important, which is, for a non-trivial Hamiltonian, very non-Gaussian. So you cannot just take a Gaussian density matrix and expect to do a good job in general, especially not where the classical approximation itself is good. So what can you then do is, I'm suggesting here, you can write a density matrix as a superposition of Gaussian ones. For instance, pure coherent states. Suppose you have an arbitrary density matrix. You can write it as a superposition of Gaussian ones where the average values of P and Q are indicated here in these coherent states. And that is completely general. And for this one, then you do your Hartree approximation and continue, as has been done many times. And then later on you average over the initial conditions for the classical variables. Now this object here can be calculated in terms of the operator of certain coherent state matrix elements of the density matrix operator. The formula looks a bit unwieldy, but that's because I've used normalized states. If I would use more normalized states, which people often do with coherent states, then these exponential factors will drop out and you just have a Fourier transform, which is still, of course, can be quite difficult to calculate in practice. But it's interesting to look at this factor here, this classical density matrix, say, for harmonic oscillator, a thermal harmonic oscillator. So if you take the quantum density matrix to be thermal with the classical Gaussian harmonic oscillator, then this is what comes out for this factor, say the classical density matrix, classical density representative.
For harmonic oscillator, we went back against the Gaussian.
Sure. Sure. This is just an example. What does it look like? Because this object isn't known very much. People usually use these days very much is popular the Bose-Einstein condensation, and they use calculation. They often calculate the Husimi form of the density matrix, the Husimi matrix, which is just the diagonal Gaussian matrix element of rho. Let me write it down here. You can calculate rho Husimi pay of Q. It's just PQ, density matrix PQ. This object is often calculated. It's nice, diagonal, has your intuitive good feeling, and so on. That is not what I'm saying here, because this is a very different object. This object is because we know how to deal such an initial state in the Hartree approximation. This object is very different. For instance, look how it behaves as a function of omega. As a function of omega, it apart from this trivial constant, it blows up very quickly. That means that this distribution in p squared and q squared is very peaked around, say, it drops off very quickly. It's a narrow distribution for large beta omega, say, for low temperatures. And another interesting thing is the zero temperature limit, then it becomes just a delta function. So zero temperature means you just have the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, and then this distribution is just a delta function, as you would perhaps expect for the ground state. Now the idea is to use this concept for field theory. In field theory, we have, say, these kind of equations for the 5 to the 4 theory, on the same footing as before for quantum mechanics. And this label K here now, you have the mode functions, you have the creation annihilation operators for every mode. But it's a K label especially related to the initial conditions. And then you have, of course, the usual initial conditions on the scalar field. In field theory, we know, it has been studied a lot and applied a lot, that this is a renormalizable approximation. It's like one group renormalization. There are no divergences. So in that sense, it looks like a real good improvement on the purely classical one, which was bad as far as gauge fields was concerned. So, as I said, it was studied a lot, applied a lot to inflation and other aspects. But usually it was done within the Gaussian approximation, where you have a Gaussian density matrix. And what I wanted to argue just before, also with the quantum mechanics case, is that is not a good thing to do. You need to incorporate these non-Gaussian features that, for instance, the classical distribution has, Boltzmann distribution. So also in field theory you can think of writing the density matrix as a superposition of these superposition over classical fields of a Gaussian density matrix. And then you have to keep in mind that generic classical fields, hot classical fields, are inhomogeneous. You couldn't stick to a homogeneous approximation here. That would be bad. So that's what we argued already in in the break. And that's what I'm now want to.
You're talking about realization, not about the ensemble level.
I'm talking about this average, where is it here? This one, this has to be, in the field theory case, quite generic, like the classical case. So these are the classical variables, so these represent classical fields, and in field theory you would then have to deal with the inhomogeneous case, and that is quite important, I think.
So I think you're correct by saying earlier. Right. Realization
samples,
the
samples
of the homogeneous.
Sorry, you're right. I misunderstood. Yeah, you're right. You pick a typical realization, and that's typically inhomogeneous. Yeah, but the whole thing can be, of course, inhomogeneous. But to start out with, to stick to homogeneous classical fields would be a bad approximation. That's what I want to stress. So we need to incorporate in these such calculations inhomogeneous background fields or classical fields or condensates. Now, in principle, that would be nice if we would know this object rho, but of course, in practice, since it involves a Fourier transform of some distribution, it's very hard. I've broken my head over it, and I think it's just not, you can't do it. So then the idea is, for finite temperature, and maybe also for finite density, say QCD-like things, is to use a microcanonical ensemble. You sample, but then now comes the real important question of thermalization, of course. You sample the system at large times. You don't need to know the initial rho very well. You just take initial values somewhere. And then it has to be, you know, some generic, perhaps it's a Gaussian, from a Gaussian classical distribution, which is generically also inhomogeneous. Like the harmonic oscillator frame I showed for the quantum mechanics case. You sample it at large times, in this way you reconstruct the microcanonical density matrix. So you reconstruct the microcanonical ensemble. This relies, of course, very heavily on ergodicity, equilibration, and so on. You could at least check independence of the initial conditions to see if it makes sense.
Total energy,
right.
The same temperature.
Right.
And look independent of
right.
Conditions.
Right.
Did you check?
No, we are in the process of doing it in a toy model, which I will also introduce and then stop. Now, in the gate theory, these modes, they act like particles. They act like the Hart, they generate Hart thermal loops. You can sort of argue that they're like the particles that Müller-Moore did in the simulation. So they are there, but of course they generate more. You have the whole thing. So I think this would be a different approach from the Hart thermal loop, which has almost become a paradigm. I mean, this is maybe there is more than just the Hart thermal loop. This is just a different approximation.
Just by the classical. You say they experience scattering.
Yeah. That's of course important. That will become a little bit clear in the toy model. But indeed, the modes act like particles and they interact via the classical fields they generate, and that interacts back on them. Now, and then you have, of course, high momenta that are non-thermal, low momenta that are thermal, but since this is a different approximation, it doesn't rely on the system, will sort itself out, and the high momenta will probably never equilibrate. They're just like, you know, KAM, TORI, that, you know, are very stable, depends on what you want to look at if you expect thermalization. Now, there are a couple of caveats, of course. One big question is, of course, does it thermalize? There was an effective Hamiltonian also for this system, like in the quantum theory. And you expect that for huge times, you know, really infinite time limit, you will get, if the system is ergodic and has the right things, you will get a distribution according to that Hamiltonian. Now, that's perhaps not what you want, because then you would also have, this effective Hamiltonian had a p squared and we'll have a pi squared in the field theory case, and pi squared, this distribution of canonical momenta, is just Gaussian white noise. That's much too wild if you look at time-time correlation functions. So that would lead to ultraviolet divergences again, I believe. But maybe there is an intermediate time, which is the time we see in practice on the computer, where you haven't reached that distribution yet, and you will have some sort of quantum equilibrium coming up. This is, of course, all not known yet. It will have to be studied, probably a lot with help of computers. Now, renormalization is done usually, say, in a homogeneous background field, homogeneous classical field. And it is expected, and nobody doubts it, that for arbitrarily smooth compared to the, say, lattice cutoff configurations, it will also be renormalized properly. But if at large times the fields get sort of rough on the lattice scale, you may wonder if this renormalization is still good enough. It is like you have a typically what you're doing in this semi-classical case is you have a one loop, say propagator. You could calculate sort of a propagator closed loop representing the sum over the modes, and then you have the classical fields coming in, and often they are homogeneous in the cases that have been studied, and that's how you renormalize. But now you start sampling this system at large time, which is to represent, say, the correct average over initial conditions. That means that these modes are going to get at least some high momentum. So you're sort of tying up these ends together, so you replace this by something like that, where you do this average over the background field. And then you might still answer, is the renormalization that you started out with, this one loop renormalization, is it good enough? I don't know. Then there is a numerical problem. If you look at the equations again.
Yes, what you suggest looks as basically one loop correction to classical mechanics. You have a classical solution,
right,
and you now write your field phi as phi classical plus something,
right,
and you do essentially one loop like that something. That something propagates in the classical field, so it's one loop like...
It's not a correction. It has to be self-consistent. That
it is self-consistent.
Yeah.
Are you sure that includes hot thermal loops for the case?
Yes.
You just know that somehow. That
includes flat
thermal loops.
I'm
just asking.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure. Even though it's just one loop. Self-consistent one loop, but it is still a one loop thing. So how do
you
know? There are no clever things like putting one thing inside. I mean, no insertions and never occur one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, but on top of collisions or related to collisions, there are things like when you calculate kinetic coefficients, they do not do that. Hard thermal loops don't do that. They do not do information kinetic sketching. But I remember they discussed color conductivity, for instance, in that context.
That's
yes.
Not outside.
Oh, this is outside.
Outside.
How can loops have to be there to regulate the calculation?
But then, okay. Now you convinced me that what Jan proposes includes hard thermal loops. But then, Dietrich and whoever you guys apparently do more or try to do more because color conductivity is outside hard thermal loops, and you deem it important, don't you? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, but...
Is that contained in here?
Depending on what will be...
I think the physics is like the physics of particles plus background fields interacting.
No,
yeah.
So it depends on if the color conductivity is determined by the soft A fields, and these are present.
Scattering that dominant color conductivity has the exchange of order of a soft rule. So GT down G squared T rules. If you treat this classically, then you have this scattering, but it's in the classical sector of the field.
Here we have a harmonic oscillator in one dimension, so I think we can be pretty safe in concluding it
No, this is field theory.
As a method to do that problem, among other sets, of course.
No, okay.
And the question is, will it do it? That is, are those scattering effects that people now deem important in the context of spiral transitions included in this thing?
Well, the way they do it, they color conductivity is some external thing calculated
by somebody else,
fed into the calculation.
Right.
So
no,
but the question is, does this physics...
But the question is, will this include that physics?
I don't see any reason why it should.
That's why I'm not asking you.
Let's keep this advice.
We're in a very simple model.
Perfectly reasonable and decent model.
We can't discuss it.
Now, the question is, does it include it in the gate theory?
Yes.
I mean, you already...
We go outside the Hart thermal loop approximation principle.
In the viscosity, when you mentioned that, you said correctly that this depends on...
That was classical.
...hard effects, which you cannot...
But there are hard effects in here. All the modes go up to the cutoff.
But all hard effects seem to be one loop, unless you have a classical version. Classical modes scatter as they wish.
No, the modes also scatter.
You also have this scattering. If you do a classical theory plus the quantum mode.
Like this.
And then you have the scattering of one hard mode emit a soft mode.
Yes.
And then the soft mode scatter another hard mode.
Oh yeah, that's called bilinear
effect.
I don't think bilinear. So this is good.
Yeah. So if your classical sector is large enough, you can scatter. In Hawkish theory, it means that you have the cutoff, the ultraviolet cutoff must be larger than GT. Then you take into account this
What this doesn't have basically is three or four hard legs.
Right.
But you tell me you don't need those for the...
I'm not sure about it. Now there's the numerical caveat, which says that if this is homogeneous, then the mode functions are just a function of time times the spatial dependencies, then sort of trivial. You have an ordinary differential equation for every k. But inhomogeneous, you would have a partial differential equation for every k labeling the modes, and that blows up rather quickly, because on a lattice with n sides in a linear direction, and if you keep the total time step also proportional to that n, so you keep the ratio of the time and the spatial lattice spacing fixed, then this numerical problem, you have n to the d, the number of spatial dimensions, modes of n to the d variables being the value at every lattice site, plus the number of time steps, you have this problem that blows up that fast numerically. Now, therefore, we wanted to try this out, or these ideas out, in 1 plus 1 dimensions in the toy model, because there you have an n to the third problem, which is still doable, and then maybe we can learn numerical techniques to deal with this blowing up in higher dimensions. For instance, I'm thinking of this similar methods. It looks a bit similar to the dynamical fermional calculations in QCD, basically it amounts to maybe we can do the mode function sums that appear in the equations by Monte Carlo. But that would have to be tested. First you want to do it exactly as stated within the approximation, then further Monte Carlo maybe on top of that. Now let me now introduce the model that we tried it out, that we are trying these ideas out, and that's a rather complicated model. Unfortunately, we started out with the sort of real physics with phalerons and all that and fermions, and that is numerically more demanding than the basic question that I just outlined to address those. So the model Gert will talk about this afternoon is Abelian Higgs field in 1 plus 1 dimensions, a gauge field, Higgs field, and fermions coupled with an actual vector coupling. Left and right have an odd sign here. There's a Yukawa coupling that mimics, say, the electric weak theory. And this theory then has an anomalous fermion current. So the idea was to study questions of baryogenesis. The normal fermion current is anomalous. The anomaly here is the usual anomaly in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And the change in fermion number is the change in Chern-Simons number, which is just the average of the A1. This is all very well known. You can put the model from the actual vector coupling to a vector coupling by a charge conjugation transformation on the right-handed field and put it in a vector-like form. In the new form, it just looks like QED for the gauge field coupling to the fermions, and then you have a funny Majorana-type coupling of the fermions to the Higgs field. And then this normal fermion number becomes really the actual charge in the new formulation. The advantage of this formulation is that you can put it on the lattice because of the well-known trouble with fermions and lattices and chirality. This we put on the lattice. Then it is convenient to go through a Majorana formulation because we have this Majorana coupling to the scalar field, the Yukawa coupling. Basically, the gamma matrices are real, and you split the fermion field formally into a real and imaginary part, then you get the charge matrix sort of being the generator in rotations in this 1-2 plane. You also split the Higgs field in a certain form, real and imaginary part. You have a matrix form of the Higgs field, as is often done in the electroweak case. And the final form that we then studied on the lattice is this, where you have like a QED coupling to the fermions and a, in Majorana form, this, well, not so bad looking Yukawa coupling. Now, let me now discuss the large N approximation in this system, which will then, and then I'll stop. And that brings us back to where I started, this sort of Hartree or large N-like formulation. We'll end up there. So basically what you do is you have N copies of the density matrix for the fermions, and you assume a factorized form. So you introduce, say, N fermion fields, like flavor, and you take that large N limit. You can integrate out the fermions out of the closed-time path integral. And the reason why I go through the derivation once more is that I want to stress that you don't need a Gaussian density matrix for the fermions to do this. You can just integrate it out, set the source to zero, for instance, if you forget about this propagator. I had another sheet which left out these details, but somehow the copier didn't want me to copy anymore. And so this basic integration, whatever it gives a factor d to the n, and n is then going to infinity. You rescale the couplings in the familiar way, and finally you do a saddle point for the Bose fields. So that gives you these equations, which are similar to the Hartree formulation I wrote down before, but this is a large N version, where the both the fields are purely classical in this case, and the fermions take the role of the modes. And you see here the fermion back reaction on the gauge field. This is like the fermion current. And this system, since the modes act like particles, I said, the fermions are treated by modes, you can imagine now more clearly what the modes do. They indeed are like, you know, it's like classical electrodynamics where the particles are treated quantum mechanically. You have similar equations for the Higgs field with the fermion back reaction. As I said, the fermions are treated by mode expansion. You have modes U alpha. Alpha could be a momentum label and more. And then you have the initial conditions on the creation annihilation operators. And that's the system. So it is, in a sense, we can already study some of the questions that I raised, some of the caveats. We can study thermalization, we can study renormalization, and we can study, of course, Sphalerian physics. I was arguing that inhomogeneous classical fields are needed to do a good job for the density matrix. Of course, they're also needed in the first place to talk about Sphalerian physics, because the Sphalerian configuration is inhomogeneous. Anyhow, this is the model we study, and I'll stop here.
Actually, tell me, remind me quickly, how are you proposing to study thermalization? I mean, what are you going to look at specifically?
Well, basically, any operator that you like to follow, you start from some initial configuration, which is not equilibrium, and then you follow that observable. It could be Chern-Simons number, it could be some charge density. Plot it as a function of x. Gert will show you what we have done up till now in the afternoon, and see if it equilibrates.
How do you attach that?
By eye.
Only by eye if it goes through.
Yeah, you can test of sorts. You have an autocorrelation time. There are quantitative measures. You can calculate autocorrelation times, which are notoriously difficult, but you can do that. But that's it. By eye is the first thing you do.
That's you could just also make a static simulation for some of the quantities, just like the theorem momentum correlation functions of the fermions or something like that, and then really compare if the dynamical system goes to this what you would statically expect.
I think it's a good suggestion. We hadn't thought about that. We probably will not do it in this model, because the model happens to be numerically quite involved, because you have lots of indices. But on a more simple model, yeah, we could do that.
What we start saying is that you'll have an idea of whether this can ever come like to something like quantum distribution.
But yeah, so but the problem, yeah, I would have to go outside the gauge theory probably, because of gauge invariance, all these the whole concept of particles and quasi particles is, as Jan noticed, that on the one hand one is asked to do the normal gauge fit correlation function, and then one is asked to not to do it. It is difficult to talk about particles in the gauge theory. So in a way I like it, because maybe those concepts are not so good. Those particles, everybody talks about adiabatic particles or quasi particles, and maybe you should just avoid the whole thing altogether and talk only about gauge invariant observables like those objects here.
Of course, in this model, you can make a life much simpler if you bother with it.
Yes.
I don't mean exactly what we did,
yes,
which was then to go immediately to classical approximation and study it this way. But no, you can bother with it. Can stay with one level.
Right.
But even this is better, because the miracle that happens with modernization is that you have no doublers.
Right. Yeah, but that's all. I think that's a very important thing to do. If to compare with. But you know, this we want a difficult system to study our methods, also the numerical methods, to be able to handle this NQ problem, to handle the mode sum. And my first reaction would be that if you would, since we have doubling in time, we like it because it's better suited numerically. So it's like the staggered fermion formulation. But that means you have two flavors. Now, bosonization with two flavors is a hell of a lot more complicated than with one flavor. you get a much more non-interacting theory, as far as I recall. So I'm not. I mean, yeah.
I would say the point is that we don't want to do something fancy. We just want to do.
We want to study the approach.
Which,
we want to study the approach just outlined, but we also want to do spheron physics and all that at the same time. Maybe this is a bit of a too big chunk to try to eat all at once. So. But we have already lots of interesting
results.
Well,
that depends on what's important for you. I mean, if the fermions are important for you, then obviously it would be more generic to study this way. If what's more important for you, as Jan was talking about a while ago,
I agree completely. It's a sort of, you know, things evolve and
other things become.
Maybe we have to step back a little and take a simpler model.
If you want to solve the system in higher dimensions, then we run into the problem that can only do very small systems. This way, good force. Is that correct?
This way, yeah, definitely, yeah. So I want first to study approximation methods, see if they work at all. If they do, we could go to higher dimensions. If they don't work, then the whole thing shatters at this stage.
If you can make some other remarks about lattices, and I don't know what you have in mind there, but
yeah, it is. Well, it is. What I had in mind is. I've got lots of sheets here, which I skipped. No, but what I had in mind was the transfer operator, which I think is interesting. And it basically, what I had in mind is telling the story. Suppose you do what the textbooks say, you have a discretization of the path integral in time, and now you don't take this formal limit which the textbooks often take and say, now we have a path integral, now we do all our formal tricks for perturbation theory, it's fine, but for the non-perturbative physics, you have to better stick with your regularization, your discretization. Then you discover all of a sudden what comes out is not what you thought you put in. The system is different. For instance, you have this fermion doubling, and I think it's interesting. It's not something that you want to wipe under the rug, because it's interesting from a pedagogical point of view. I would like to see it in every textbook in a certain sense, but since I've been talking for 2 hours now, I see no point in continuing this pedagogical, perhaps not for everybody, interesting thing anyway. So we can. I will say, I didn't know how long this was going to take. I mean, could it take only 1 hour? And then I thought, well, maybe people feel sort of short of of talk and I could continue, but this definitely hasn't happened, so I would propose just to stop it. But that's what I wanted to talk about, yeah. The transfer operator, it's how you do it. It's fairly simple and very instructive, but could do it another time.
So, I think the schedule says 1:30. Do we need 1:30 or come? Let's really be back though. Try to be back at 1:30. Really sorry, 1:30. Not at 1:40.